Welcome to the Pendulum Insight Podcast. This is a show for deal makers in the blockchain business, where we meet the players who are changing the game today and get their insight into everything from the red tape to the raise. This is your host, Colton Moffitt. Let's get started. Hey everybody, today we're joined by Seth Hornby of ZenChain. ZenChain is an exciting blockchain startup focused on building financial and security decentralized applications, primarily on the Ethereum network. He's going to talk to us today about one of their primary projects, Monitor Chain, some really interesting stuff that they're doing now, the story behind it, and what they've discovered lately, which is still very timely and should be quite interesting for everybody. So Seth, thanks for joining us. And why don't you tell us a little more about yourself, ZenChain, and Monitor Chain?
Thank you very much for having me. To give a little background on myself and the company, I've been in entrepreneurship in the online space for about 9 or 10 years now. And prior to starting ZenChain at the beginning of this year, we were working in online software. We're dealing with PC utilities for Windows desktop PCs, both in the creation and the distribution and marketing of those platforms. And we actually just recently completed an exit back in October of this year from that company. And this was sort of a partial pivot over to the blockchain space. Mm-hmm. So with ZenChain, we build decentralized applications currently on the Ethereum network that we're looking to expand. And our two primary ones are LendCoin, which is a peer-to-peer decentralized lending platform. So users can make customized loans and financial instruments using a wide variety of cryptocurrencies. And then our core flagship is Monitor Chain, which is a security application that looks for the signs and symptoms of hacks, theft, and fraud, and alerts the key stakeholders automatically in real time. Which would be the exchanges, those who hold the tokens, and those who've created them and have the degree of control.
Excellent. So you and I have had an opportunity to talk before this recording, and I want to make sure that we don't assume any knowledge on the part of the listener. The focus of this podcast is primarily deal-making activity within the blockchain space, so partnerships, fundraising, acquisitions, things like that. But there are a wide range of investors that will be listening, and so why don't you tell us about some of the security issues, specifically in the instances of fraud that inspired the creation of Monitor Chain and how you've evolved to respond to those threats since you founded it?
Absolutely. To go back to the inception of the product, it actually goes, there've obviously been many, many, many hacks and fraud, smart contract exploits. Over the years, the blockchains existed. The most notable one would be the first, which was MT Gox. It was many years ago the number one Bitcoin exchange, and its poor practices led to the loss and theft of millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin, and actually ended up tanking the market, which took years to recover. In more recent years, on Ethereum, once it was created, there was an incident called the DAO, which was arguably one of the first ever ICOs, and due to a hack that was actually because of a fault in the Ethereum ecosystem itself, a large sum, about $300 million, a massive chunk of the Ethereum that was in circulation at the time, was lost. And to undo the hack, they actually ended up having to split Ethereum via what's called a hard fork. And so the Ethereum you know today is actually a variation of what Ethereum was back then. And if you've heard of Ethereum Classic, that's actually the version of Ethereum that chose not to address this issue because they didn't want to take the precedence of undoing hacks. More recently, as you've probably heard of the ICO craze, most of what people know as ICOs are actually tokens, basically a new cryptocurrency that lives within another blockchain. And in almost all cases, that is Ethereum. And these are built by what are known as smart contracts, which is self-executing code to basically create these tokens. And unfortunately, there are tons and tons of exploits because, well, the code is only so good as those who created it. It's a very new emerging space where some of the best practices simply don't exist. exploits are found every single day. And so these incidents are rampant. The way we actually founded our product was we were building our peer-to-peer lending platform, LendCoin. And there was a major incident where it's called the batch overflow exploit. But basically what it is that people failed to account for what happens if extremely high numbers were input into fields that went beyond their limits. And in this particular case, it allowed a hacker to more or less take control of the entire token and use it to print money. And so in over 10 of these major ICOs, they did this and they created numbers so long they don't fit on the screen. I don't even know how to, how to actually describe them. And of course, what they did is immediately afterwards, they sent these to exchanges, resulting in millions and millions of dollars of losses by many of the top cryptocurrency exchanges. Wow. When we saw this incident, we had our lending platform and we thought, well, what happens if we were live in a couple of months and a similar incident to this happened? How would we stop ourselves from falling victim to this? And we realized we had no solution. We looked around, couldn't find anything at all on the market. And so from there, we decided to build our own solution, which as we've gone through it has ended up becoming a more important project to the company than the lending platform itself has been. And over the preceding months, we've obviously managed to detect a number of other security incidents related.
Yeah, and it seems as though beyond just the significance to your company, the functionality of MonitorChain and this problem that it's solving may actually be more significant to the blockchain ecosystem at large. So now that you've given us an idea of the security issues that inspired it and the security issues that have been caught and kind of addressed and learned from in the meantime, there's this piece of news that you shared with me the other day, and people, by the time they hear this, will probably be aware of it. So why don't you tell us about the Rust Gas issue and how you discovered it and what's going on there, the latest updates? We're probably going to spend a good bit of time talking about that. So why don't you just kick things off with the background and go from there?
Sure. Well, I'll start by explaining kind of the nature of the situation in case there's anyone who doesn't quite understand the nature of ICOs and the exchange ecosystem they're traded.
Sure.
While obviously a lot of them have been marketed as what are called utilities, which means that they claim to not be a security, in most cases, the ICOs are essentially a digitized security. They're in many ways similar to a stock. But since it's digitized, it's based on a computer contract, it also has degrees of modification. And in the particular case I'm about to get into, and many of these others, there's the ability for people to move things around, change the supply, in the same way you would as a stock issuing new shares. You can do so with these tokens, if not coded to be unable to do so. So the incident we detected, and this was on the 28th of November it first happened, was we detected a small Russia-based ICO from spring of this year. It raised $2.2 million. It's called RusGas. And what they'd done, or someone had done, was their total supply, which was 10 billion of these tokens, instantly changed to 110 billion, an 11-fold increase. Now, as I said, we look for the signs and symptoms of hacks, theft, and fraud. An 11-fold increase, I think almost everyone would say, certainly qualifies as the type of issue that people would want to look deeper, because it certainly looks highly suspicious at a glance. We emitted the alert to all of our subscribers so that they can take preventative action, or at least know not to get involved until they figure out what's going on. And upon our own personal investigation, we went and we found that all of these tokens had very quickly been sent to an exchange called CREX24.com. We looked more in depth, because you can tell what's occurred. And what we found is that these tokens had been sold on this exchange, all of the newly minted ones to users. Within the first 24 hours, we were at about $250,000 worth of Bitcoin that was sold. The next day was about 100,000, and well, I haven't updated because unfortunately this incident is still occurring. We're in the 500 to 600,000 US dollar range worth of Bitcoin that's still flowing through this, albeit a lower rate than it was initially.
Yeah.
And the incident has been ongoing, and now the supply has gone from that 110 all the way up to 860 billion. So we're now at 86 times the issuance than there was. And I'm sure anyone who holds or trades stocks out there probably wouldn't like to know that a stock they hold had increased its supply by 86 fold, and they've been diluted by a factor of 86 with no prior notice. And no apology and no protection at all.
So
which is what's happened here.
Yeah, that's more than doubled since we talked last night.
So. Yes, it continues. They've actually finally, we managed to, after some internal communications, trying to get hold of these teams, and the actual ICO, Rust Gas, have not responded to anything from us. We've been in communication with the exchange, CRAX24. They've refused to halt trading, which is highly irresponsible, in my opinion. But it seems that our efforts to bring attention and a media report of this yesterday have at least caused them to be more aware of the scam. And I won't say it certainly hasn't stopped, but at least they've escalated their cover up efforts.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny too, because you said it's roughly 500,000 to 600,000 in, you know, US dollars, but in Bitcoin. So they've got it in Bitcoin. And that is funny because, you know, right now Bitcoin's US dollar exchange rate is not so hot. So, and now imagine if the people who are really hoping that turns around early in 2019, this might actually end up being well into the seven figures for these guys.
Yeah. If we were to look, say, at the price of Bitcoin back a year ago at its peak, this would already have been rounding $3.5 to $4 million in losses, based on the volume of Bitcoin involved here.
All right, then. So tell us a bit about how Monitor Chain detects something like that. You know, you told generally there's a volume increase that trips into kind of a sensor that you set up. You know, you've got some parameter that defines, hey, look, this is too much, this is what's normal. Is that something that you've all decided as a team and it's hard-coded? Is that something that's variable? How does that work?
So essentially what we do is we've built a set of nodes that monitor every transaction that goes through the Ethereum network. Fortunately, with the blockchains, one of the nice things is there's a full degree of transparency. You can see every transaction as it occurs in real time. And what we've done is we've taken over 700 of these ICO and Ethereum tokens that are built on Ethereum, and we've implemented rules of what essentially is what they should and shouldn't do. At the basic level, things, you know, can be done quite automated. Like it's very irregular for a token to have an 11-fold increase in its supply. But what we've also done at the more granular level for some of the larger tokens, and we continue to work through with key ones that we've chosen based on those who work with us and market importance, is we look directly at the token, which means we analyze their code. We take a look at their white papers, their public filings. We mark the key addresses that belong to the exchanges, belong to the team members, belong to any decentralized applications that hold large amounts of volume. And we build in rules for what anything that's been either encoded or documented of what should happen, which allows us to catch things such as illicit insider trading or the exploit of something else that's on the token. For instance, if there's an exchange and that exchange that holds the tokens is hacked, we can detect that as well by these methods. And in fact, one of our core use cases is for exchanges themselves to essentially act as a redundant second layer auditing system in real time to ensure, as unfortunately has happened with many security incidents involving exchanges, which is that they keep poor ledgers and allow double withdrawals and allow funds to be siphoned off. We basically provide a real-time sanity check to all of their numbers to ensure that, for instance, a rule we often use is that whatever individual account has the highest balance of any asset on an exchange, there should never be an outbound transfer from the exchange higher than that amount. So we build these rules, and they're basically customized. And then when we see a violation of those rules, our system automatically puts it into a ranking of what we consider a severity level, and we send out those alerts to the level of severity. And then users of our platform, for those who've chosen to automate it, can take action, such as halting trading, freezing of a token, attempting to reclaim assets, or just handling their PR efforts, dependent on what their own risk tolerance or how they see the error.
Sure. Okay, that definitely gives a better idea. So let's say I own an exchange, you know, me, my company, we own an exchange, and we want to benefit from that. We have our own internal systems, but what you're saying is it needs to be there something independent, because from a security perspective, one of the first targets, of course, would be those internal monitoring systems if you're going to go and try to take from an exchange versus attacking exterior to that. So do the instances, the way that this is set up, monitor chain, if I have an exchange, somebody else has an exchange, and then somebody else has an exchange, are those instances of monitor chain sharing information in a way that's not compromising the security of each one?
Exactly. We use several nodes with a small consensus method, so that if one's compromised, it involves a critical mass of them to be compromised to actually send out a false alarm. Going back to your initial point with internal monitoring systems, and to be quite honest, unfortunately, in cryptocurrency and exchanges today, the levels of internal monitoring are wildly, wildly below what people could consider even the most basic rudimentary standards of security. So we don't consider it anything overlapping. But the bigger issue at play here is that not only do you have to have your own internal security, is you can be impacted by the rest of the world, because you don't hold all the assets. You have these cryptocurrencies being sent to and from your exchange all day, and so you need to be protected from what's out there, because if an exchange trades 200 different cryptocurrencies, they not only have to protect their own exchange, their own security, their own wallets, but also if one of these tokens that they trade is compromised, then they can essentially be the dumping and basically the pawn shop to fence these stolen or counterfeited goods, which is most likely in most security incidents we've seen in 2018, that is actually what's occurred, which is that the exchange itself is not compromised, but the exchange, by not being able to detect the assets being transferred to them, are stolen or hacked or involve a token that is currently dealing with a major security incident. They allow it, and then those tokens are quickly sold to their users, and then they take another cryptocurrency that doesn't have such an issue and get out. And unfortunately, the people who are usually left holding the bag are the users these exchanges, at least in the short term before legal action.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, short of the kind of thriller action movie scenes of people on, you know, fucking crotch rockets and meeting up and handing over USB drives, that's not happening. People are taking it to exchanges that are not well secured, and they're turning over millions of dollars worth of stolen tokens and crypto. So,
yeah, one of the big things that people aren't always aware of with exchanges is most of them use what are called liquidity pools, which means that when, you know, if you have an asset traded on 10 different exchanges and someone quickly sells a lot on one exchange to drop the price, the other exchanges, through bots, through arbitrage, and through these liquidity pools, send more over. So even if you only hold $1 million worth of a coin and someone tries to dump a bunch of, onto that market, it'll refill itself over and over and over again to allow massive, massive amounts of theft to occur in a very short amount of time.
Right. Okay. And from that perspective, then, if you're in a liquidity pool with somebody else, just because you are running a monitor chain, just because you're having top of the line security standards and procedures, everything's perfect. Just by being in that liquidity pool with somebody who's not well secured, you could actually end up being affected as well.
Well, and that's actually the benefit of why people would use monitor chain, is because we would, by the fact that we're monitoring everyone, the full ecosystem, and not just one independent part, it can be used to inform not to restock through a liquidity pool.
Sure.
You're throwing good money after bad, for lack of a better term.
Gotcha. That's an interesting case. So let me just go back to something that I wasn't entirely clear on. And when it comes to this, the way that you've taken, say, the top, you know, largely used high market cap, these popular tokens, and you've done that you've worked maybe directly with those teams, or spoken to somebody, or at least read closely, versus exactly. The other ones, you might have to check out the white paper and kind of get the intent. Regardless of how you're doing it, you're getting the intent, the general substance and spirit of what they're trying to achieve, to decide what those rules would be, because each one's going to be a little bit different. Right.
Exactly. So that requires,
how big is your team? I mean, because that seems like it'd be pretty labor intensive.
It certainly is. And that's why we've only completed this for about 50 of the 700 that we're going through right now. But we're working from top to bottom, and it is somewhat of a top heavy market in terms of valuation. So yeah. It's certainly time consuming, but we can usually do these things in relatively short order. And obviously we're currently looking to raise capital to grow the team and vastly accelerate that process as well.
Sure. That's an interesting thing that you were able to catch Rust Gas, even though, correct me if I'm wrong, it's not necessarily top 50. So
No, that's that one actually wouldn't barely even fit in the top 700. Right. That one was, you know, we have some very advanced, very highly scientific rules in place, and in this particular case, we didn't need them. The lowest. This was caught by the lowest hanging fruit. It was as obvious as you can get, which, to be blunt, was a little worrisome on my end that we caught this. I believe that the first time we noticed anyone else had even detected the incident was 5 days later, which is a bit of an indictment on the state of security within the blockchain space, that this can occur for so long, and it exploited another nasty thing that I've noticed now that I've checked, that many institutions are using this, which is a minimum selling price.
Sure.
So basically, whenever you have a price range, and if we look at, say, US dollars, you can't go lower than a penny. Right? You don't have a denomination smaller than that. With cryptocurrencies, the same exists, but usually it's about 8 decimal places. Mm-hmm. So on a lot of these exchanges, you can only go down to, 1/8. It's called a Satoshi, which is 8 decimal places to the right of a Bitcoin.
Right.
In this particular exchange, it actually was 1/100th of that value, but nevertheless, there's a minimum selling price. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is, if there's an asset that's at that minimum selling price, it means you can keep selling it and the price won't go down. Mm-hmm. And this represents a really nasty security vector, because it means, in normal circumstances, if you try and dump a large amount of the asset down, even with liquidity pooling and arbitrage, the price will drop catastrophically. So in this case, because it was already at the lowest selling price, it didn't, which allowed them to extract massive amounts of value from this. So it's a little hard to wrap your head around, but they managed to extract, as I said, over $500,000 from a coin that was only valued at $20,000 to begin with. simply by the fact that they could just keep endlessly selling, and then periodically pausing and propping the price back up with a few well-timed small buy orders, and then repeat, rinse and repeat. And so they were able to get at least 20 times the entire value of the market capitalization, which is almost unheard of, but looking around, it's something that we've detected that is a high risk on many exchanges for many different assets. So it's something that we believe that those in the industry should be very well aware of going forward.
You know, that's something that did not cross my mind until just now when we were discussing this before, was that, first of all, this one's ongoing, which is, that's okay. So if you're listening to this and it's only a couple of days after this recording, it may still be ongoing, and you should do whatever you can to let people know. And here's why. It's not just this one, but all of these projects that have failed, if they catch wind that, hey, this worked for these guys, even though there was no hope or future for that particular project, probably. I don't know enough about it to say that for sure.
But we can say it was certainly a very long shot already.
Right. One of the many, you see these statistics floating around, 80% of ICOs are scams, 90% of them have failed utterly, whatever it is, these projects are still out there. The code's still out there. They're still on the exchanges, whatever it is. And it doesn't take much for somebody who says, you know what, screw it. This was a humiliating failure for me. Why don't we just do the same thing, guys. And you get a couple, you know, 25-year-old guys in a room, like, hey, screw it, let's just do it. And there's all these exchanges out there that have this same problem. And there's all of these different coins or tokens that have generally the same position in the marketplace. If people do not find out about this quickly and the information does not become common knowledge quickly, it's very likely to have a copycat effect for a good long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite frankly, it is. It's this incident is wanting to give criminals too many ideas as really exposed on what unfortunately is a high risk opportunity for them, in that there are these more or less dead or low value coins that are still traded on exchanges, that still have, by way of their social media presence, a loud microphone to spread misinformation, and can exploit these situations. And if the team is corrupt or had poor security practices, can very easily have it taken over, or a rogue team member executing these issues themselves. Yeah. And without improvements from the exchange security level, this is almost certain to recur and continue. And we've seen it occur in waves, and the drop in cryptocurrency prices over the last 8-9 months had temporarily slowed it. But now that things have reached a new low, we've seen a heavy resurgence in the last month. We saw a ton of these incidents in the spring and early summer, followed by a bit of a lull. And then the last month has been definitely a heavy amount of escalation, as we see teams that maybe were not totally fraudulent, but unscrupulous, have now decided that it's easier to simply turn to pure fraud.
Yeah, that's something that we touched on in this discussion. As a team, and again, we're speaking in general terms for the moment, but how do you differentiate between something that was a fraud from the outset and something that maybe seemed like a good idea, maybe it was half-baked, maybe it had potential, but it just didn't work out. And now you're 12 months down the line and things are not as good as they were 12 months ago by a long shot. And, you know, leases on Lambos are not cheap, and new mortgages that you qualified for before, whatever. I mean, obviously a mortgage is a stretch because of the type of wealth it was, but still,
of course,
the lifestyle that they probably got themselves into. Mm-hmm. And then now that wealth is not there and they need to find a way to cash out. And then they find out, oh, wait, we still can. And we could probably get away with it. It's an interesting environment we're in. And you're probably, you know, you caught this one, what was it, 5-6 days ago?
We caught it on the 28th of November. While we sent the alert, we tend to err to the side of caution and do our diligence before making any sort of public announcement on, you know, something being an actual fraudulent or security incident, sure, which we did the following day. We didn't receive any word from anyone until the 5th of December. And it was only yesterday and today, the 7th, where we've actually seen some action, which is almost exclusively due to the fact that a major crypto news publication picked up the story and brought some attention to it that hasn't been done other than more or less facilitating and pure cover-ups of all we've seen prior.
Yeah. So which publication was that? So the listeners can go check it out.
CryptoSlate.com.
CryptoSlate. Okay. Excellent. We'll put the link in the notes for this one. And, you know, if somebody else is working in there and they're doing security related work for this space, as I hope more people will be soon, and they want to reach out and they don't really have the kind of marketing savvy that you do from your background, what should they do? How should they go about getting in contact with the people at publications like CryptoSlate to make sure that it gets out there in a timely manner?
What we found is most effective is a combination of trying to reach to the reporters directly through social media. You do have some success through the tip lines of these publications, but it is a little bit hit and miss because as we presume that many of them are hit by quite a bit of spam. And unfortunately, some of them are more of a pay-for-play type environment, the ones that tend to publish mostly press releases. So it is somewhat of a numbers game, but fortunately, what we found is that there is actually quite a few people in the media who want to bring light to scams and negativity and help clean it up because there many of them are actually true believers in the potential of blockchain and cryptocurrency.
That's good. That's very good to hear that. And, you know, it's great that CryptoSlate picked that up. So when you're looking at, you mentioned before that you're looking at raising some capital, and I'm imagining partnerships would be important too for just the, if it's collaborating on research, development, marketing, because you need to, A, get the information out there that there are companies like yours doing this kind of important work, and B, you're at about 50 out of 700 different tokens that need to be evaluated and learned from. So which kind of partnerships do you see being most valuable for Monitor Chain and Zen Chain at large in the near future?
For us, in the short term, the exchanges themselves are by far the most valuable partnership, simply because we need to get the buy-in and the critical mass to create this level of self-enforcement. There's a large number of organizations, many that are already involved in security, such as smart contract auditors, as well as those who create and market the tokens before they go to market, to basically do preventative. And obviously, we always say that prevention is much better than curing something that's already caused these issues.
Right.
So we like to get in as early as possible. So partnerships are obviously very valuable with the firms that market, that develop, that do the compliance work for these ICOs before they go to market. But first and foremost, certainly, is the exchange, because it does take a critical mass of adoption to clean up the bad actors in the space and prevent this recurrence of inadequate security measures leading to and encouraging these ongoing scams.
Yeah. And widespread adoption of something like Monitor Chain could eventually be something to be effective in an immune system for the entire crypto marketplace or the token
Absolutely.
Exchange.
One of the things that has been a trend, at least in people predicting where the market will go, is a replacement of what these have been called security token ICOs to utility token ICOs to a model of security token, which is fully regulated, registered, transparent, basically tokenized stock. And with these, as they're brought to market, they're obviously meant to be considered more traditional financial investment vehicles.
Right.
And a huge concern with those is going to be in the security, because incidences like we've discussed with RustGas there, you certainly cannot have institutional investors having to cope with an incident like this. And yeah. It also brings in the component of insider trading, which, while it should be a concern in the ICO space and current cryptocurrencies, it unfortunately is not, due to the lack of regulation. With security tokens, this absolutely is the case. And what we've seen thus far is most solutions aren't really focused on stopping, or they're focused more on setting up a proper system and legal regulations, but very little in terms of the actual monitoring and being able to alert should a rule be broken.
That's an interesting angle that, you know, the STO stuff. We talked to the guys from Dealbox yesterday, and they were telling us about the partnership with TokenIQ and how TokenIQ is actually embedding the token recovery mechanism, the KYC, AML stuff, all the compliance stuff, rather than making that a burden of an exchange or whoever the issuer. It's actually built into the token. I don't know exactly from a technical perspective how to express that, but I found that pretty fascinating.
Yeah, there are some new token standards that do have the ability to lock transfers, to do revocation, to embed decentralized identity solutions. And these are great. These are a great start to it, but there's always a weakness. There's always a degree of attack vectors. And there's always the fact that even if something can happen according to the code, oftentimes it shouldn't happen. And the issue with smart contracts and tokens like this is once they're deployed, they cannot be edited. Mm. The entire thing is recreated. So it does pose many limitations. And so while those solutions go a very long way to lessening these risks, and I think are fantastic and need to occur, they're not a full solution because there still are remaining weaknesses left to be addressed, which we intend to fill in those final gaps.
Sure. Yeah, that's very, it's a challenge. I mean, the security, the fact that people are taking such a strong look at it from how that is being approached from a regulatory standpoint versus what you're doing, which is technical and practical. And I spoke to Dr. Hubert Risdorf of Chain Security in out there in Switzerland, and they've done some fascinating stuff too. And their smart contract audits is their focus, but the prioritization of that, especially as people want to see the institutional investment come in and seeing how that develops. I mean, what you're describing, look, you can put that stuff into the token, you can code everything just how you want it to be. But as we know from decades of using the internet, just because you had good intentions, yeah, everything seemed right. It's only right until some 13-year-old in Romania decides it's wrong and, you know, changes everything that you intended.
Exactly.
So, and in that case, that goes back to you know, monitor chain, not just deploying what you have as your final product out there. Obviously you're going to keep updating it, but also working with other people that are involved in that security space, I'm imagining, to really understand the intent of these new and more complex tokens, right?
Absolutely. And there are some other firms out in the space that are doing great work in trying to bring this information to light, to increase the transparency, to make, you know, to give better information. Because one of the major issues with cryptocurrencies, and especially with these ICO tokens, is it's incredibly hard to put a proper valuation on them, largely due to a lack of information, which has led to values which are unfortunately based more on technical analysis, price manipulation, social media hype, rather than any sort of fundamentals, because there just hasn't been a way of establishing those. And we think it's great that people are bringing this information out there, because once that information can be analyzed and we get a little bit more mature in the space, real valuation models are going to start to emerge over the next year or
two. Yeah. I would look forward to that. I find that stuff fascinating. I like to talk to the venture capital and private equity guys. And if you're a trader, a day trader listening to this, you know, don't kill me, but sometimes the technical analysis of just, it seems a lot like witchcraft dressed up in scientifically appearing dressings, but you know, I'm sure it works for some people. There's some very wealthy traders. I've met some people who have killed it in Forex and just trading in general. But it seems like for every one of those, there's just an absolute slaughterhouse of people that did not make it through. So I guess that's just how it goes.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned that there are some other companies that you think are doing some great work in the security side of things and in the accountability side. For anybody who's listening right now and wondering who can they trust in this space, is there any one company, any individuals that you would recommend without hesitation?
That's always a difficult question. There's been a large degree of improvement over the previous months, because a lot of the past influencers of 2017, early 2018 were found to be tainted by insider interests. So the biggest thing I would do is look for those publications that actually are providing full compliance of their own holdings, their disclosure statements, and those that are basing transparency. I would try and look for anything that isn't a conflict of interest. If they're trying to sell you a product based on their ability to make money promoting certain cryptocurrencies, it makes it very hard to trust that they're unbiased in terms of their reviews of those currencies or their data that they're giving out. One that we've seen that we really like their data is Messari Crypto. They're one of those groups that are trying to bring a lot of that transparency and open information. And while looking at what they have, it's not a complete set yet, it does provide a lot of valuable insights into certain aspects of the transparency.
What was that name again? Could you spell that?
Messari, M-E-S-S-A-R-I. And I apologize, I don't have their domain name.
That's all right. So if you're listening now and you want to go check them out, then just rewind a little bit. It'll be okay. You know, what I find so important about that is that, you know, of course you're not saying 100% certain these are people that you can absolutely trust all the time, but they've at least caught your attention as people who are worthy of a second look and probably could be trusted. That, even just that level of trust that needs to start evolving in this whole blockchain economy, or it's going to rot away faster than it grows. So I appreciate that. Now, because this is a two-way street, if we could introduce you to someone to benefit your efforts at Monitor Chain, or simply for the sake of curiosity, have a beer with them, whatever, who would that be? You're welcome to be as specific or as general as you'd like, and we'll see how we can help.
What we would consider the ideal prospective partner would be either cryptocurrency exchanges highly focused on security and compliance themselves, or those who are heavily involved in the nascent stages of bringing these security tokens to market.
Sure.
Primarily the exchanges and those facilitating, as you said a few minutes ago, the companies that are involved in baking in the KYC, AML, and transfer restrictions into the tokens to facilitate these more regulated markets are actually exactly the type of individuals that we want to work with. Because we are seeing somewhat of a divide in the space right now. There are those who want to keep it as an absolute unregulated wild, wild west, which, while we certainly disagree with that, it unfortunately makes it hard for us to work with those who don't put a value on security, compliance, transparency. We'd much rather work with those who do, because they see the value, and personally, I think they're going to be around for a lot longer than those who are playing so fast and loose with, unfortunately, yeah, other people.
I think it's understandable. Both sides are understandable, and generally it's both sides of a very, very similar group of people. I mean, you have some people that are outright crooks, obviously, in every single situation in the world, but by and large, most people have a pretty similar frame of reference, kind of grew up reading the same sorts of things, thinking about the same kinds of concepts, and how much we want government involvement, how much people want banks involved, for instance. I've had some fascinating conversations with some people that they want adoption, but they want adoption without banks getting involved, which I find it's like, hey, look, guys, you know, banks aren't necessarily the enemy. We could, yeah. Right. But then there are people that are listening right now, like, hey, man, F you, I'm deleting all your podcasts. I'm never listening again. So there is a line. There's an anarchist in my heart, and then there's a capitalist in my wallet. And I just don't know exactly where that line falls.
It's difficult. My opinion is that the closest thing to a happy medium is a degree of self-regulation. Because obviously, especially in the blockchain space, so much has been grown out of more anarchist libertarian ideals and as a rebellion against, quite frankly, fraud created by governments, banks, and centralized institutions, which Bitcoin, Ethereum, and these other cryptocurrencies really are a liberation from. But as we've seen, especially over the last year, is that we really have, unfortunately, let the fox into the hen house. And so there's a mess. There's heavy, heavy market manipulation. There are tons of outright scams, and there are many bad actors.
Yeah.
And so to grow, these need to be mitigated and in most cases outright removed from the market. And to a degree, unfortunately, government and regulators are getting involved and need to be involved, but their necessity and their heavy-handedness can be reduced and lessened by a degree of self-regulation, which is what we're really trying to tackle ourselves. With Monitor Chain to try and provide solutions that aren't going to be so heavy-handed and throw the baby out with the bathwater. Because if you do have banks saying that everything needs to go through a centralized institution with multiple day delays and no degree of anonymity or privacy and locked out to the elite few of registered traders, it's going to be, you know, it's going to take away a lot of what the blockchain is and should be. So we really think that self-regulation helps to prevent that nightmare scenario of more or less ruining the value that's been created here.
Yeah, absolutely. And that kind of self-regulation and taking the responsibility for it is something that I think is so important, because even if you take the concept of a libertarian concept or an anarchist concept and you take away from it the connotations of chaos and a complete lack of rules, it would actually be advisable to think of it as the epitome of self-governance. And if you can't be responsible for yourself and you can't work with people and find market-driven ways to solve these kinds of problems, then yeah, people that like to solve problems with force and court orders are going to come in and they're going to do it for you. So we have a bit of an obligation to share these ideas and to say, hey, look, what are we going to do to limit the kinds of things like we're seeing happen with this Rust Gas situation, where you've got an exchange, a centralized point, potentially at least not doing what they could do to help prevent other people from losing money from the unscrupulous or irresponsible actions of another organization. So
we're on day 10 of the incident, which I can't see anyone seeing this as acceptable for no other reason than there's a lack of transparency and open information. The website of Rust Gas up till this morning when they released a little addendum based on our notice was lying, essentially. They had not disclosed an 86-fold increase in supply while simultaneously selling that on the same exchange. The exchange made no note of it and had set up a system where things could be dumped without modifying the price, No disclosure to the users, and 10 days of being aware without taking action. So
yeah,
it's hard to see that that is acceptable even under the most libertarian free market ideals because you have even the most diehard libertarian in me can't see that as being all right. And obviously we'd vastly prefer to have these solutions solved by a degree of self-regulation and preventative measure, being able to shut trading when an incident like this occurs, rather than having the government come in, step in and destroy 90% of the grid with
small. Yeah. Money. It's kind of one of those things like, come on, guys, you're making us look bad. I mean, it's one thing if you want to go smoke weed in the public park, I'm not going to call the cops on you, but don't be the dude who blows cigarette smoke in the baby's face. You're doing too much. So I appreciate you taking the time to explain these issues. And we, you know, myself, the people that are listening, want to try to connect you with the people that you'd like to be connected with. And we also appreciate you recommending some people to check out. So now I want to get to the fun part, though, the fun part for everybody, my favorite part of the show, which is the favorite deal story. So an interesting negotiation, clever application of leverage, best outcome, serendipitous opportunity, whatever stands out in your mind and will teach a lesson to the listener.
Sure. Well, I'm not sure this quite fits, but the most recent deals we engaged in were the exit of our PC utility software company, which we completed in October of this year, and some NDAs prevent me from going fully into the high degree of details and specifics to it. But there were a couple of major lessons learned. And one of the larger ones was that it's never good to hold onto a declining asset for too long. Mm-hmm. As we unfortunately realize, and sadly for many people in the cryptocurrency space are probably realizing that now with their holdings, we were involved in a space that unfortunately was having a heavy regulatory crackdown itself. And largely it was fueled by antivirus companies and the browsers more or less just deciding to excessively flag a lot of applications, trying to go after rogue actors and bad players, but catching too many with very heavy-handed tactics that threw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
And essentially, the problem that our organization had was we held on too long. We had some early offers at a higher value, and we tried to ride through. And by being involved in the situation, we weren't able to see the larger industry trends. Yeah. And then as a result, unfortunately, taking a much lower valuation. But when we did get to the 11th hour and finally did sell, one thing that was more of a silver lining was that when you look at an entity, oftentimes you can find value in areas that you don't necessarily think. We based our valuations heavily at first off of revenue based on recurring users, on revenue streams. And then what we found was, and it was almost accidental in the diligence of someone who ended up being a tire kicker and not a serious buyer, was that what we'd taken for granted, a back-end management system that was a very specific system that was for updating Windows drivers on the back end to serve customers active for support, for technical management, ended up being by far the most interesting portion of the company. And so we ended up leveraging that in our future negotiations. And we went from getting no's to getting a strong amount of interest and managed to get a successful, in relative terms, exit as a result. So the real lesson we learned from that is that especially when you're in the middle of things, you need to try and put yourself in the shoes of others and look at what has value to them more than to yourself. And especially in a business that's been more of a going concern, oftentimes a focus on revenue and the pure numbers can get you away from your true value. So we ended up finding being able to get into numbers to do NDAs. A core small part of the IP ended up being more valuable than the actual revenue of the business itself.
That's a good point. You know, that the revenue is kind of, it can be very dependent. And if it started having issues for you, then that means anybody who's going to buy it is saying, hey, it's going to be an issue for us too, because we don't even know your business the way that you do. So they might think they could do better if they're strong on marketing or they have the right relationships in place. But that IP being in there, that touches on something that I just talked to the guys at Dealbox about, which was when you're going to sell a business. I mean, if you can, prepare to be ready to sell that from the very day that you launch it, be building it. Exactly. But beyond being aware of that fact from the outset, also think about the person who's going to buy it. And they're thinking to themselves, am I going to be able to sell this if I need to or when I want to? And like you said, about think about it from the value for them. It's not just what are they going to do with it when they acquire it. Yeah, they're going to make money with it, or they're going to put it into their business. Sure, bolt it on, whatever. But there's that question for them. Anybody who's investing in anything, a lot of the time is the question, like, if I need to sell this or when I want to sell this, can I? Is there going to be a buyer? So sounds like it worked out for you in the end, though. Congratulations, by the way.
Yes, fortunately, we were able to pull things off in the end.
Excellent. So now I would like to invite you to share any final words of wisdom on the topics of blockchain, security, or anything else you'd like to impart to the listeners.
Sure. Well, it may not be the news that most people are hearing right now, but we actually believe that despite a lot of negativity in the space of blockchain recently, that there's actually been a lot of very positive developments over the last months and years. They don't get reported on. Unfortunately, with a bear market, you usually just hear price crashes and you don't hear about technological improvements. But I would advise the listeners to take a closer look, maybe not so much buying in ICOs, but looking into the blockchain space for opportunities, because now that we've seen this major crash, that we certainly don't know if it's over yet and how much further it can go. But what it's done is it started to clear out a lot of the dead weight. And what will emerge when we hit the bottom is probably where there's going to be a lot of opportunities to explore. And yeah. So that's where I personally see a lot of opportunity for entrepreneurs and investors to get involved with, is once we do eventually finally bottom out, keep a very close eye on what starts to emerge, because we really think that that's going to be the next big thing, whatever comes out from that, whether it be the security token offerings, which my personal opinion is, or something else. We do certainly see that as the area of opportunity.
Excellent. Well, thank you. You heard it here first, everybody. Seth Hornby said, Bitcoin's going to $1 billion in January. No, I really do appreciate that. It's a nice balanced look at things. As you said, a lot of the news right now, it's often the same news that just puts out whatever they're paid to say. They balance that with doom and gloom, because it gets a lot of clicks. So they have to combine the audience and be able to sell the positive reviews. It's really hard to know what's true. You know, the good news is bought, and the bad news is to get you there to look at the purchase good news. So got to be careful. And in order to have them learn about ZenChain, Monitor Chain, where would you like them to connect with you? What's your URLs? Go ahead and tell them how to get.
Absolutely. Well, our company website is zenchain.com, though our flagship product is monitorchain.com. And to reach out with me, which I highly advise anyone who is interested to do so, my email is seth@zenchain.com.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, Seth. That's Seth Hornby, everybody. ZenChain and monitorchain.com. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Pendulum Insight Podcast. If you learned something today and you want to know more, go check out PendulumInsight.com.